down here, but the heavier rain at this point now is predicted to be north of I-94. Also, you're advised to stay away from Lake Michigan beaches today because of risky swimming conditions. Our high today, 73. There is some light rain beginning in our western.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to explore one facet of the world around us and a facet of science that I think many of us have, with which we have very little acquaintance. We are talking about the materials that are all around us. The table you're sitting at, the chair you're sitting on, the remote control that you're holding in your hand, or the screen that you're looking at, or the book you're holding in your hands. All of these things, of course, are all made of various materials. And there are scientists who devote their time and energy and expertise to studying the material world and various materials, their properties, and the way in which they can be manipulated in order for us to understand more their intrinsic properties and the way in which they can be useful to us in various facets of human life. My morning show guest is one such materials scientist. Her name, Dr. Anna Puszewski. She is an award-winning materials scientist. She describes herself as materials generalist, working at the front line of new materials technology. She actually secured her first patent at the tender age of 22, and her career since then has taken her into areas. She also is a freelance science communicator, speaks a lot about science and material science in particular. She even does stand-up comedy about her work, and she about materials, which, like her book, is titled Handmade. The full title of this book is Handmade, A Scientist's Search for Meaning Through Making, in which Anna Puszewski explores. So beyond the realm of the microscope by which she, as a scientist, might examine them. Really interesting to find out first a little bit about how you found yourself in this particular discipline. It sounds like it was a bit of a surprise. You tell us something about it in the first chapter of the book. Tell us about what your aspirations at that point in time were, and then the slight deviation in course that ended up occurring.
Yeah, like you say, it was a complete accident, my way into material science. When I was in high school, I was choosing between two different paths. One of those was actually college and try and make it in the music world, and the other was to become a scientist. And I decided that I could always have music if I continued it as a hobby, but it's harder to keep science as a hobby. So I applied to lots of different universities, wanted to apply that to the world of science. So physics seemed like quite a good fit. One of the universities that I applied to was Oxford University. And in the year that I applied, it just so happened that their Department of Material Science were very low on a lot of people realize you can go on to study at undergraduate level. I certainly hadn't heard of it. But because they were so low on degree for material science, so I took them up on their offer to have, you know, an extra free shot at getting into Oxford. And I went up. When you interview at Oxford, you go up for about 3 days and you stay in the colleges and the halls of residence. And so I had 2 days' worth of physics interviews where I would go into these very stereotypically Oxford academic offices. If you're imagining a leather sofa and, you know, and shelves of old books, that would be exactly right. It was exactly as I expected. I'd be grilled by these physics professors about all sorts of different areas of physics. Very, very strange questions they often ask you. Things like, how many cups of tea can you make with a water bowl? Stuff like that. And actually, when I went, I was extremely unwell. I had a really, really bad, like, flu-like illness of cold. My eyes were streaming. My nose was streaming. I was trying to stem it with tissues and all sorts. And it was not an especially... not an especially attractive attempt, I would say, attempting to get into Oxford. But on the final morning of my stay there, I had my head in the material science department, so it wasn't in a sort of stuffy academics office. It was in sort of just a very neutral meeting room. I met three or four of their professors, and we just sat down, and because they knew that I hadn't applied for material science, there was, I suppose it was just a lot more relaxed, I guess. I felt that it was very relaxed, and we had a lovely chat about materials. You know, they sort of told me about what material science was. I remember they sort of plonked this great big heap of metal in the middle of the table between us, and they said, tell us about this object. And that was a real insight into what material scientists do, is that they use the world of science to engineer stuff, engineer materials to make useful things for the world. And so... after I left Oxford that Christmas, I remember it was Christmas Eve that year, and I heard the post flop onto the doormat downstairs, and my dad creep up the stairs holding this cream envelope, and he handed it to me and then retreated. And I opened up this envelope, and he said, congratulations for that opportunity of interviewing with them. And then I, of course, couldn't turn them down, couldn't turn that offer down. So off I went to go and study the subject that I...
When one is studying materials, it very quickly becomes a lot more than just holding this object in your hand and, you know, maybe throwing it down and seeing what happens. I mean, it is actually a serious study that takes things down to the atomic and sometimes even the subatomic scientific realms. At one point you write, learn to read the language of atoms and you'll unlock the mysteries of the material world. And so it sounds like a lot of what you did in the laboratory as a material scientist involved looking through a microscope and looking into the atomic world. And I guess what this book is about is examining materials in a different way. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, my scientific comfort zone is doing exactly as you described, using scientific instruments to understand the different types of atoms that we find off the periodic table, how they bond together with their neighbors, and also how they construct these beautiful patterns and symmetries, how they, a bit like building blocks, how they build up, how they structure together, and how all of that information can lead us to understand why materials are the way we find them, so why steel, for example, is very strong and hard and that we can build buildings out of it, or why rubber is soft and flexible. All of those materials properties we can understand by looking at the atoms and what those are up to at those very tiniest scales. But this book was all about examining materials from another side. I won't say the other side, because science and art, I think, are often, you know, pitched against each other. Actually, this book was about exploring the similarities and the symmetries and the differences between my comfort zone world of material science and the realm of makers and artists and craftspeople who are equally as expert about materials, but from a slightly different perspective.
Maybe one way in a pressure gauge you were using, and you were told to take this to a new department called the Institute of Making, to have this pressure gauge maybe repaired, if they could repair it. And you write about their having what you call an uncomfortable epiphany. Explain what that uncomfortable epiphany was.
Well, I'll set the scene for you first so you can picture exactly what this epiphany was about. The Institute of Making is a fantastic department at University College London, where I was doing my PhD. It's a department that brings together engineers and anthropologists and artists and crafts people, everyone with a love of materials, into the same space to work together and to collaborate and to work next to each other. And in that space, they have what they call a materials library, which is a collection of over 1,000 objects that represent a vast range of both materials and making processes. And the physical space looks a bit like a museum. There's lots of these different shelves, lots of strange objects and glass bottles. The larger objects are sort of uplit behind glass, or, you know, a particular crushing epiphany that you speak of happened that I was standing looking at an enormous wall full of materials, because that's when I realized that my knowledge up until that point had all been gained on paper. So the world of academic material science was very much about studying the maths and the physics and the chemistry and the engineering of materials in a very scientific and academic sense, you know, all on paper. Whereas when I stood in front of this big wall of objects, I was confronted with the physical materiality, right? So there was the bark of a tree, and there was this glowing green crystal vase, there was a rubber duck, and all sorts of materials in between. And the atomic world leads to materials properties that we've talked about. I couldn't identify most of what the stuff in front of me was even made out of, let alone how it was made. I understand it's a material, it's a ceramic material, it has all these different insulation properties. But a beautifully crafted teacup has so many more properties than just what the material affords it, right? It has sort of sophistication, and it has aesthetics, it has beauty. And those aspects of materials I had never really encountered before. We don't have a theory that tells us how atoms arrive to make beauty. And so that was the bridge that I wanted to cross, was understanding how the making processes and the sort of human input into materials gives rise to handmade things, and sort of what that means for us as humans and as a society.
Well, your book ends up being, in a sense, an odyssey in which you go on to some of this further exploration. I think you say at one point, this book is the story of a naive scientist's exploration of materials as used in the handmade world. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Anna Pozaisky, and we're talking about her book, Handmade, A Scientist's Search for Meaning Through Making. And now I'm missing the rest. Steel, brass, clay, sugar, wool, wood, paper, and stone. Can you help us understand what this list represents? I mean, at least in a basic way, does this represent the kind of the entire scope of materials that are around us? Or did you pick and choose these particular materials for any particular reason?
A bit of both, I think. It was very challenging to choose only 10 materials, as you can imagine. And what I wanted to try and represent was the journey of a scientist from the materials that I'm more familiar with and more comfortable with, so those, because that's sort of more in the comfort zone. And then as the book goes on, as the journey continues, we get to meet materials that aren't studied at all in material science, making practices that I'd really be able to get my hands on, if you like. But added to that, so that was my first approach, was I wanted to have a range of different materials, some from more the world of science and some from more the world of craft. But added on to that, I wanted each of these chapters to be a story in its own right. So it's sort of a collection of short stories as well as a book overall. In each of these short stories, I wanted to reflect an aspect of my life, I suppose, outside of science, because I wanted to show how materials tell stories in our lives. And what I hoped was that the reader would read these stories and then maybe reflect on how materials have impacted their own life as well. So to give your listeners an example, my chapter about plastic was actually, although it's the story of how plastic was discovered and invented and how it was went on to become such a prevalent material in our world, the story of that chapter actually is the story of my Polish granddad, who was born in 1910 at around the same time as Bakelite was first developed in New York by Leo Bakerland. Stories, and then weaving the materials and the making around those stories.
And I do appreciate the fact that the book is a real mix of fairly heavy, intense science, but, I mean, you are very good at kind of spelling a lot of that information out in a way that is accessible to those of us who are not scientists, nor even maybe all that scientifically inclined. So I appreciate that that there is as much science as there is and that it's presented so well. But yes, set within the context of very human stories, and in particular and it is a wonderful chapter in this book, and unexpectedly personal. I wonder if we could just talk for a moment about one of the key questions raised in this particular chapter, which, in your words, is what happened to turn this material hero into a modern day villain? That is, what happened to plastic, which once upon a time was something that was, really in nothing less than a godsend. I mean, and made life better for so many people in so many ways. And now so many of us see plastic in a very different way as kind of a scourge on the planet. And that's a really interesting question that I think most of us are not really stopping to answer. Without going into every fascinating detail raised in your book, sketch at least for us kind of the bare outline of that move from plastic as hero to villain.
Yeah, it's really fascinating, isn't it? For me, that we were using the dust, what's actually changed to make it from hero to villain is us and how we use it. And I think particularly how we value those materials. What makes plastic villainous in today's world is often the materials properties that make it fantastically useful as well. Material properties like the fact that it is so incredibly lightweight. And don't forget that we also make airplanes and car components out of plastic for that reason as well. And so in that way, it has a net benefit to the environment. So it's a very complex issue. So anyway, lightweight nature, that's such a really so incredibly cheap. So cheap, in fact, that we don't see that as having any sort of value whatsoever. And that's a real key issue. So lightweight, cost, and also the incredible ability of plastics to be really anything we want them to be. Like, we can make plastics that are soft and flexible like a synthetic rubber, and that are completely transparent and are very, very thin. And all of that kind of magical chemistry that goes on behind the scenes to make of this massive family of materials that we call plastics, all of that has helped to, as you say, change people's lives, change the way that we live in the modern world. The way that we live in the modern world would not be possible without plastics. But those issues around how lightweight it is and how much it costs is what has kicked it, in a way, into becoming problematic. Because it's those factors that mean that we use it in an irresponsible way. It lasts in the environment if it makes its way there. It's also not that durable, and so plastic objects tend not to last as long as their textile or metal equivalents. And so the volume that we're producing has to go up, the volume that we can produce goes up because of how cheap it is. And so what we end up with is the situation that we see ourselves in today, where we've made so much stuff that we don't really have anywhere to put it. And so because it's lightweight, it makes its way into the environment as the winds blow and the oceans, you know, rise and fall. It ends its way up there. And that's where we see it become a real environmental villain, because we see it in loads of sea turtles and we see it floating around in giant Pacific garbage patches. And we think, this material has got to go. Well, actually, what's got to go is our attitude towards it. Where plastic carrier bags at a grocery store used to be free of charge, so you could just take as many as you wanted and fill your bags with your shopping. They then started introducing a very small charge, 5 pence, right, about 5 cents per carrier bag. And we saw usage go down by 80% overnight, because by adding a very small value to that plastic bag, suddenly we made different choices. And we need to see those sorts of mind shifts happen across the board when it comes to how we're making our material world.
Hmm. I want to ask you about a specific line in your book that intrigued me a lot. And you called this, and the particular uncomfortable truth that you share in this chapter is this: plastic is currently indispensable to this modern world that we have built for ourselves. In other words, to be the implication of what you're saying. Is there some kind of way in which we need to change that as well, the indispensability of plastic?
I think yes and no, because if we snapped our fingers and we removed all plastics, lots of things would happen in society. There'd be loads of unintended consequences. For example, if you think about food, the reason that food is relatively cheap for most people is that plastic packaging allowed it to be shipped around the world safely and stored for much longer. If you think about medicines, the vast majority of medicines are packaged in plastic. So if we didn't have that, we wouldn't be able to treat people of diseases, right? So those two examples, cheap and available food for everybody, including the poorest in society, and medicines that disproportionately affect the poorest in society. What we see when we start making sort of ideological changes to how we use plastics, we start seeing vulnerable people being most affected by those changes. So the point there is that materials are inextricably linked with how our society functions. And if we want to live in a society where people can live their lives and live comfortable and happy and healthy lives, then unfortunately plastic plays a big role in that. And that's one of the reasons why it's so hard to get us off this material, because it has a lot of net benefits in society as well.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Anna Pushaisky, author of Handmade, A Scientist's Search for Meaning, chapter of the book, which focuses on glass. I so appreciated this chapter because I think a lot of us have glass in our lives and never take a second to stop and think about what an incredible substance it is. Your chapter on glass in Noob, and you were sent, I think, to the glass blowers in the chemistry department. Wherever you were, I think you say there were 2 full-time glass blowers employed. And that was one of the first times you ever saw this being done. Describe in a little more detail what you saw and why it made such a strong impression on you.
Well, first of all, I had no idea that there were resident glass blowers in the chemistry department before I needed them. And after I knocked on the door and entered their little workshop, The scene was absolutely incredible, because what these two guys did was work, as you say, full-time, making bespoke glassware for the chemistry department. And this glassware, it takes, because glass is so malleable when you heat it up, it takes all these amazing different forms. And so there was obviously test tubes and beakers, as you would imagine, but also all these sorts of snake-like tubes that were inside bigger bubbles of glass. There was just glass absolutely everywhere inside this tiny little workshop. And it was sort of like entering a different world. And, you know, you'd hear the kind of roar of the blowtorch in the corner and the clinking of these different glass articles around. And it was the first time, I think, that I'd ever really watched a craft person working. So when I handed over watch to the glass and started heating it up. And the weird and wonderful thing about glass is that, unlike metal, when you heat metal, you know it's hot because it glows orange, which in itself is a very beautiful thing. But with glass, it's a little bit more tricky because nothing changes visually as you heat up glass. Metal instruments very, very gently to understand the viscosity, so the runniness of the material as they're heating it up. And they need to understand how the material is going to flow, given the temperature that it is. They need to understand how it's going to form a bond with a new piece of glass. The way that it moves, the speed with which it moves, is very, very beautiful to watch. And so what was a relatively easy fix for this expert, I was absolutely transfixed to watch. And it was that experience of watching that really made me realize that these skills are ones that I really want to learn a bit more about. And that was what led to the book. Hmm.
You touch on the long history of glass. And this was interesting to me. I mean, as I was reading this part, I realized I've never stopped to even think about how long has there been something called glass. And you remind us that, you know, occasionally we see it occurring in the natural world, kind of, but brews that occurred that allowed glass to be, in a sense, safer and more usable.
Yeah, I love this story, because it's a story where, like you say, glass has long been a friend of science. If we go back into history, for the vast majority of the time that glass has been around, we've been using it for scientific things. So the first microscopes would need glass lenses. Just over the telescope, so glass helps us see very, very small and very, very large. And the alchemists of old, those who were trying to transmute lead into gold, the early chemists back in history, they were using glass loads, because what they wanted to do, what glass allowed us to do, was to see what was happening inside. So what the alchemists were trying to do was to turn lead into gold, and the main way that they would see if they'd done that would be to see it change from dark silver to gold colored, right? So they needed to be able to physically see that change. There aren't that many materials that you could hold molten metals in that would be safe. Ceramic is one, but ceramic, of course, is completely opaque. And so glass is a material that would allow them to hold their experiments in, heat them up very, very hot, to melt them down, you know, attempt to create gold. The problem, though, that they would have encountered all the way up in history to around the mid-19th century is that glass, when you heat it up, expands very slightly. Now, in fact, lots of materials do this. Metal famously expands when you heat it up appreciably, and it causes all sorts of engineering problems. But glass as well expands a little bit when you heat it up. And if you heat glass too quickly, in the part that hasn't. And because glass is very, very brittle, what can happen is basically it smashes everywhere. And so the alchemists of old would have probably been very used to their experiments being scattered all over the walls and ceiling when their glass container for their experiment exploded. That was the case with a material called soda-lime glass, a sort of very typical sort of glass, very basic formula for glass. But all of that changed with a guy called Oxford, that's the brand name. And like I say, it doesn't expand at all when you heat it up. And so also Schott's glass, it really changed the way that chemistry was done, because now you could heat up glass as much as you wanted and you could be pretty sure that it wasn't going to all blow up in your face.
You also tell us in this chapter that when it comes to the transparency of glass, which of course is in a sense the book, but we leave it to our listeners to explore that on their own. I wanted to have you just touch also on one fact that as you watched glassblowers at work, their fascinating work, you tell us that at least the basics of glassblowing are largely unchanged from the earliest days of this art form. And I have a feeling that maybe for some who are practitioners of this, that maybe one of the things that draws them to it is the fact that when one is engaged in glass blowing, you're basically doing the very same thing that was done centuries ago. And there aren't a whole lot of things in our modern life where we can say that.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. And I think that holds true for many of the different crafts that I had a go at. These traditions, this knowledge, is passed down from craftsperson to craftsperson throughout history. And really, it's quite humbling as a material scientist, because material science has been around for probably less than 100 years as its own particular discipline. Whereas, as you say, some of these crafts have been around for thousands and thousands of years, and that knowledge base, clay and wool, and we really stand on their shoulders. You know, their foundation allows us to study materials in a laboratory, but we absolutely couldn't do it without the hands-on knowledge of, you know, people like blacksmiths who started this game.
Love that. I also think in the chapter devoted to brass, it's so touching when you say that my trumpet is the physical object which I love more than any other. Just share with our listeners whatever you think is especially intriguing about the material of brass, and particularly how personal this exploration was for you as someone who has been and continues to play the trumpet.
Yeah, brass has a very special place in my heart for that very reason. It's a nice material, you know. It's nice to work with. It's relatively malleable. Thin sheets of brass you can manipulate with hand tools, you know. It's a very sort of friendly metal to work with, if you like. And I also enjoyed writing this chapter because, of course, I got to, you know, tell lots of personal stories about why the trumpet mattered to me and how it had formed my experience and my life. The history of metallurgy through the trumpet, which is a very ancient instrument, in the tomb of Tutankhamun, the Egyptian pharaoh. And there's all this, what do you call it, like pharaoh's trumpet, through sort of military associations, as we started to be able to make trumpets out of more practical materials like brass in sort of Roman times and onwards. The military associations of the trumpet have remained throughout history, actually. But then as we take it through the sort of classical period and the romantic musical period, as society and culture was adding colour in all sorts of different ways, particularly musically, you know, as the romantic components were starting to add many more interests to that, if you like. And so in the 1700s, we start to see very rudimentary trumpets with buttons that allow them to play much more intricate music and romantic, almost jazzy music, if you like. But the lovely thing that I learned was that the vowels of the trumpet, the three buttons that you see on most trumpets, those arose because of, or they arose at the same time as the steam engine. So it's the same mechanism inside a steam engine that turns, hot steam into mechanical motion. That was one of the great things that paved the way to the Industrial Revolution. That same technology also went into the vowels of the trumpet. And so I loved that story of how metalworking, music, and society and culture all came together in this intricate story of the history of the trumpet, of not only metalworking, but also music and what a trumpet even can be. When I asked him about the sorts of materials that we might see in the future of trumpets, he was talking about ceramic valves that don't need to be oiled. He was talking about electric valves. He was talking about gluing the components together instead of brazing the metal as you traditionally would. And so it's a very exciting example, I think, of how our musical culture...
I want to mention that towards the end of the book, once we have moved past steel and brass and clay, we move on to a substance like sugar, which is a really interesting chapter where, among other things, you talk about the way sugar can be manipulated and shaped in spectacular fashion. And there is a lovely story that you tell in the chapter that is devoted to wood. And I think that would be a lovely note on which to finish, in which you talk about a certain tree that was in your grandparents' yard and a certain object that will always hold a very special meaning for you. Can you tell our listeners about that?
Yeah, this object that you're talking about was a bowl, a wooden bowl that had been handmade by a bowl turner. And the wood of it came from probably my all-time favourite tree. And that tree, as you say, was in the back garden of my maternal green grass. And in my sort of childhood memory, it was absolutely enormous. It was a walnut tree. And I have such fond memories of childhood and my grandparents in that particular space. And having grown up and left home, a few years later, my grandparents learned that the tree had some sort of disease, and actually it was unsavable, so it had to be cut down. But because it was so meaningful for the family, they decided to make something out of the wood and sort of allow everyone to have a piece of that special tree to keep. And so that's what that bowl represents, is that wood and those memories and that tree. And I think wood is that sort of material, isn't it? It's quite a sentimental material. It physically markates time passing. Lots of listeners will know about tree rings and how every ring of the tree depicts another year passing. And when I think about, my grandparents and all the years that passed in that garden, I think it's very fitting that wood should represent those times and those memories. It's a very, very special object to me.
Mm-hmm. You tell us wood is probably our longest standing material, and you pose an interesting question when we think about wood as living thing made material by craft. What was this magic? Search for meaning through making. The book is published by Bloomsbury Sigma and the author, Dr. Anna Puszczajski. Thank you so much for this marvelous book, and thank you for the pleasure of speaking with you about it on The Morning Show. I really enjoyed this.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for all your fantastic questions.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I look forward very much to speaking with Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, who was recently granted the highest teaching award that can be given in the University of Wisconsin system, the Regents Award. We'll be talking with Professor Shaler about his long and distinguished career at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside and all that he has done both inside and outside of the classroom. On Wednesday, we will be previewing this weekend's Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival. And we'll continue that preview on Thursday by speaking with the headliner of the event, Grammy Award-winning guitarist Norman Brown. And this Friday, Greg Eisenberg and his fascinating book, The Streak, which takes a look at the long-standing record of Lou Gehrig